separated by the government in another era, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Immigrant families separated at the border are in the headlines now, but they're not the first to be split apart by the U.S. government.
I think my first reaction was, oh my God, this is what my mother went through.
Connie Reitman's mom was just 5 when she was taken from her parents in California as part of a federal program to assimilate Native American children.
Her hair was cut. She was not allowed to talk her language. There was a lot of abuse and hunger, and all she could think of was to get home.
And later, an update on the whale that appeared to grieve for her deceased calf for more than 2 weeks.
In my personal opinion, she was grieving.
Those stories coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. The battle lines over immigration are showing no signs of letting up. The latest group to cry foul over the Trump administration's policies are immigration judges. Their association has filed a grievance over attempts to pressure them to speed up deportations. It follows the Justice Department's removal of an immigration judge in Philadelphia who was told he was acting too slowly on a deportation case. This comes, of course, against a high-charged backdrop of immigrant families being separated at the U.S. border. Court orders have reunited some of the families, but that hasn't stopped many Americans from viewing the family separations with sadness and outrage. For some, this story is all too familiar and personal.
I think my first reaction was, oh my God, this is what my mother went through.
This is Connie Reitman. She lives in Sacramento. She grew up on Pomo Indian settlements in a rural part of California. The story she's talking about, the story of her mother, has been passed down the generations. She shared it with KQED's Vanessa Roncagno.
Connie Reitman didn't hear this story all at once. Her mother doled out details gingerly as Connie was growing up, weighing how much her children were ready for. It took years to tell them.
And all of us would lay in the bed and she would be sewing and she'd tell us about things that happened to her in the boarding school.
A boarding school for American Indian kids set up by the federal government in the late 1800s.
I think at first it was more about the things that she enjoyed about it.
She talked about learning to sew and cook at the school. As Connie got older, the story got darker.
I was probably about 11 or 12. And I think that's the first time we heard the part about when she was taken from the family.
One day in the mid-1920s, when Connie's mother was about 5 years old,
there was a knock on the door, and it was a federal official that said that my mother had to go to school.
Until the mid-1930s, it was federal policy to assimilate Native Americans by eradicating tribal culture through a boarding school system. There were 25 of these schools in the U.S., including 3 in California. Federal officials forced parents to release a certain number of children from each reservation. Connie's family has never known why her mother was taken, while other kids weren't.
Not very much was able to be said or done. She was just taken.
Taken from her home more than 200 miles away to Stewart Indian School in Nevada.
So my grandmother and my grandfather didn't know where my mom was, and they didn't really know how to get a hold of her.
Tens of thousands of kids were put in boarding schools, where government reports described hunger, overcrowding, disease, and hard labor.
As we got older, she related, you know, how at the school, her hair was cut. She was not allowed to talk her language. There was a lot of abuse and hunger, and all she could think of was to get home. For the most part, we didn't hear those parts till we got a little older. And I think that she felt we could bear it.
Connie's mother contracted tuberculosis and was sent to a hospital in San Francisco. After 2 years of treatment, she was allowed to go home. She was 14.
When my mother came home, she was not really accepted, ever really accepted back into the tribal community because she'd been gone.
For so long, she'd been away about 9 years. The trauma of these experiences shaped her life. But it also shaped Connie's. That's why seeing children separated from their parents today feels so personal to Connie. It's why American Indian leaders around the country have come forward to condemn the actions.
It's a good opportunity for America to be able to relate to what happened to us as tribal people.
Connie Reitman's almost 70. Her mother passed away more than 20 years ago. She's dedicated her life to working with tribal communities around this legacy of trauma. She says we can't heal if we don't remember our history.
We don't want this to keep happening to families, to children, because we've been there, done that. and we know what it's like. These wounds are generational, multi-generational. That's why we have to tell the story.
For The World, Vanessa Rancagno, San Francisco.
Tomorrow we'll hear another story of a family split apart, but from a different time in history. Federal government crackdowns on immigration is not a new thing. Far from it. Just in the past decade, before President Trump got into office, President Obama oversaw so many deportations that immigration rights groups nicknamed him the Deporter-in-Chief. And before that, the George W. Bush administration got tough on immigration.
Illegal immigration puts pressure on public schools and hospitals
state and, local
and brings crime to our
communities.
It is against the law to hire someone who is in this country illegally.
My heart is really breaking.
This is an absolutely massive action.
This is a clip from a documentary made by the Univision TV network. It's about a massive immigration raid that took place in 2008 in Postville, Iowa. More than 1,000 immigration agents took part. The documentary is called America First, The Legacy of an Immigration Raid. And it was reported by Almudena Toral. My colleague Marco Werman spoke with her recently.
Almudena, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what happened in May of 2008. This was during the Bush administration in Postville.
Yeah, in May of 2008, in a tiny town in Iowa called Postville, there was a huge immigration raid. I think it's still one of the largest worksite immigration raids in U.S. history. And it happened in a kosher meatpacking plant. It was a plant called Agri Processors, and this plant served as the main economic motor for the town. 389 workers were arrested, and 287 ended up being deported, mostly to Guatemala.
And tell us a little more about Postville, Iowa, and how many years migrants had been coming there to work at Agri Processors.
Postville, Iowa, it's a very interesting town. It was traditionally created by German immigrants, so it's always been an immigrant town. And as I said before, very agricultural, traditional, lovely town where everybody's very nice. And it wasn't until the early 90s that Latino immigrants started coming in, and that was because of the need for workers. Of course, these jobs at the meatpacking plant that had traditionally been filled by locals, working in meatpacking traditionally was a very good job that paid really well. But then as the needs for the meatpacking industry started to change around the country, and we as consumers started demanding cheaper products, so cheaper chicken in this case, for example, it ended up all across the country, meatpacking plants ended up switching labor, and that's how Latino immigrants started to come in Iowa, because locals didn't want those jobs anymore. They are dangerous jobs, and they really didn't pay as well as they used to in the past. So for locals who could get other jobs, it wasn't really worth it. So that's where Latino immigrants came in to fill in that void. And they became a really strong presence both in the state and in this town in the 90s and the 2000s.
And what about the people who were not deported? What happened to them?
Some of them managed to stay. There were a certain number of people, mostly women, who managed to stay because they had small children and nobody else who could take care of them. So in that case, when they were honest with immigration agents about that situation, they were let to stay in the town to take care of their kids with ankle bracelets. So they were constantly being monitored, some of them for over a year. Some of them reported, of course, being very inconvenienced by having to wear these ankle monitors and not being able to leave the town and all of that. But some of those people were able to later on, years afterwards, regularize their situation through U visas or some other sort of arrangements. But the truth is, the town lost almost half of its population right after the raid.
We'll get to that in a second and what's happened to the town, but I want us to meet Heidi Castillo, who is a subject in this documentary, and her story.
Me siento rara por no tener a mi familia cerca de mí, pero mi madre
maestra dice que soy muy valiente.
Katie's an amazing girl. She was a baby, only a few months old when the raid happened. So, of course, she doesn't remember the actual day. When she was, again, a baby, her mom took her back to Guatemala because the dad was imprisoned and they were not being able to be in touch for over 6 months. So the mom, who was also undocumented with three little girls, including a small baby, got really scared. They didn't know if ICE was coming back. They didn't know if it was safe to leave home. They certainly were scared to leave home to work. She decided to go back to Guatemala with her family and wait for news from the dad. Then the dad was deported and all the family was there. But again, economically, they really struggled there. They couldn't send the girls to school. And when a friend of the family said, look, I'm going back to Postville. Do you want me to take your U.S. citizen girl with me? She'll be able to get a better education. They decided to give it a try. They decided it was better than for her to stay in Guatemala and not be able to go to school.
Almudena, this is a raid that happened in 2008. George W. Bush was president. And then under Obama, deportations increased. What is instructive today about this raid in 2008 as Trump eyes deportation, not to mention other practices, as tools to inhibit immigration?
The public outcry about this specific operation was so huge. Again, $5 million were spent on this specific raid. Over 1,000 agents descended on a 2,000-people town. It was a massive operation, received a lot of criticism. We have not seen any massive worksite raids after that other big one after Postville until Trump became president. So, of course, Obama was the chief deporter. But in terms of worksite immigration raids, we really saw that trend descending. And now that Trump is in power, we've seen it increase exponentially again. So just in the last few months, there's been massive worksite raids in Ohio, in Tennessee. And just a couple of days ago, there was one in Nebraska where 130 workers were arrested. So it's certainly like we're seeing those tactics, the exact same tactics used in Postville, used under Trump. So I think it's relevant to sit down and think about the effectiveness of these raids. Do they really work? Do they really achieve what they are supposed to achieve or what politicians say that they will achieve? And what are the long-term consequences of those, both personally and also economically, for the towns and the nation in general?
Almudena Toral reported the documentary America First, A Legacy of an Immigration Raid for the Univision Network. Almudena, great to meet you and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Almudena was speaking there with Marco Werman. You can check out her full Univision documentary about that 2008 raid in Iowa over on the World's Facebook page. Just ahead, the story of the Iraqi spy who infiltrated ISIS. You're with the World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Iraq announced the defeat of ISIS forces late last year, and members of Iraq's secretive counterterrorism unit, known as the Falcon Intelligence Cell, played a critical role. One of the key members of that unit was Captain Harith al-Sudani, who worked undercover, posing as an ISIS militant, before he was killed in 2017. Iraqi intelligence sources credit him with preventing 30 vehicle bomb attacks and 18 suicide bombings. Sudani also gave his Iraqi colleagues direct access to some of the senior ISIS commanders in Mosul. Margaret Coker is the New York Times bureau chief in Baghdad. I asked her first why the Falcon Intelligence Cell was created in 2006. 2017. Iraqi intelligence sources credit him with preventing 30 vehicle bomb attacks and 18 suicide bombings. Sudani also gave his Iraqi colleagues direct access to some of the senior ISIS commanders in Mosul. Margaret Coker is the New York Times bureau chief in Baghdad. I asked her first why the Falcon Intelligence Cell was created in 2006.
Iraq was just convulsed with terror attacks. Baghdad was shaking. The South was shaking. You know, there was absolutely no way to stop what at that point was an al-Qaeda insurgency here. So the Iraqis were trying to figure out a way to keep their citizens safe. The director of national intelligence is the man who decided he was going to try and lop off the heads of al-Qaeda. And so he created the Falcon Intelligence Cell to do just that, to go after the leaders of the jihadi movement in Iraq.
And then it morphed into going after ISIS militants.
That's right. So the Americans had to withdraw from Iraq in 2010, 2011, which left a very big hole in terms of intelligence gathering here. And of course, there's been lots of editorials and even books written about how America might have dropped the ball on jihadis here regrouping into Islamic State. Well, the Falcon Intelligence Cell had never dropped the ball. They have been working here on the ground and redoubled their efforts. So they have been responsible for some pretty big operations after 2014 when the Islamic State invaded Iraq and took over a third of the territory. The Falcons have been trying to infiltrate the terror group and also try to take out more of its senior command.
Now, Captain Harith al-Sudani, he joined the Falcon Intelligence Cell in 2013. How did that happen?
Captain Harith is a really accidental hero. I mean, he was the oldest son of a very traditional family, and he had a lot of expectations on his shoulders to be the most successful son, and he fell flat. He was flunked out of university. He had basically a glorified desk job, and he had a younger brother who was the original recruits into the Falcons unit. And his younger brother, when the Falcons were looking to expand, tried to convince Harith to join the unit because he had some crucial skills that the Falcons were looking for, and he got in.
And he ended up playing a really large part in the Falcon Intelligence Cell. In 2014, after ISIS seized large parts of Iraq, Sudani volunteered to go undercover. What kind of missions was he assigned as an ISIS recruit?
There was a string of terror attacks that hit Baghdad in 2014 and killed lots of civilians and lots of children. And so Captain Harith al-Sudani told his commanding officer that he wanted to volunteer to be an undercover agent. He wanted to do something more active because, as his commander told me, he couldn't sit by and watch Iraqi children be killed.
It's amazing. In reading your article, you're kind of riding along with him. It's very vivid. Can you tell us about a specific mission Sudani was involved in while undercover? Give us a sense of how it all worked.
Right. So they had to create a cover story for him, like in the spy novels. He spent a lot of time training and getting his cover story intact. And he infiltrated the Islamic State known as Abu Suhaib. And Abu Suhaib, his cover was that he was a regular, like, unemployed guy from Baghdad. And as a Baghdad native, what Islamic State wanted him to do was bring suicide bombers and truck bombers and try to create havoc and terror inside the capital while they were fighting the coalition and other Iraqi forces up north. So Captain Sudani spent 16 months trying to foil suicide bomb attacks. And when Captain Harith would take a vehicle bomb, he had a pre-arranged telephone code that he would alert his unit that another bomb was coming. And so they would scramble to intercept and then ride with him in chase cars along the highways leading into Baghdad. And the unit would have safe houses around the capital. So they would direct Captain Harith to one of those safe houses. They'd quickly dismantle the bomb. And then they would send the original vehicle to the targeted site in case Islamic State had other spies on the ground watching him. That's the other way that they tried to keep his cover intact. Then the Falcons would put out a fake news release so that if they were watching the news, they would think that their bomb was successful.
Being undercover is a really dangerous job, especially the longer you're undercover. What finally gave him away to ISIS leaders?
So he's been, unfortunately, dead for more than a year. And, you know, the Falcons have been trying to figure out exactly what might have given him away. The best that they can piece together is that he had made a couple of mistakes on some of his missions. He wasn't in the place he was supposed to be. So maybe that's when the suspicion started. But the final moment when the gig was all up was this New Year's Eve bombing operation that he successfully foiled on New Year's Eve in 2016, because it turns out that Islamic State had put two surveillance devices inside this vehicle bomb. And so when the Falcons unit were dismantling the bomb, Islamic State was hearing all of that happen. So they knew at the end that he was a spy.
Has Sudani gotten recognition for his work against ISIS since his death?
his family and his unit, they're convinced that one of the people executed on a Islamic State propaganda video was Captain Sudani. There is no corpse to be found, and there's no positive identification on the video, but they're convinced that was him. You know, no one saw him after this last mission. The day that that propaganda video came out, both Falcon's unit and Iraq's joint military command put out statements praising his bravery and praising his sacrifice. But since then, the family has struggled to get his pension for his work and also what are known in Iraq as martyr's benefits. They haven't been able to get that because they haven't been able to produce a body. And according to Iraqi law, in order to be declared dead, you need a corpse. However, I can say that over the last few days since my story was released, the story of the sacrifice has just taken the nation by storm. The prime minister's office has been in touch with the Sudani family yesterday. They've sent someone over and they've told them that they'll clear the way for the family to get that pension and get those martyrs' benefits now.
One of the things that struck me in reading your article was, in many ways, the Iraqi military has been criticized that they weren't really up to the task. You know, the Americans were doing everything. And the story of Captain Sudani really belies that. I mean, have we really underestimated the Iraqi contribution in the war?
Yes, I think we have underestimated the Iraqi contribution in the war. This is not the Iraq of 10 years ago. There has been an enormous amount of professionalization that has gone on within the Iraqi security forces over the last 7-8 years. But in addition, there's an enormous amount of morale and pride in the country. And in 2014, when the nation was overrun by the Islamic State, volunteers came in droves to try and reverse that. There's a much more healthy sense of nationalism here and national pride. And part of that is the fact that people banded together and were on the front lines together. They were the ground troops to help defeat the Islamic State. The coalition has done amazing things as well, but it was the Iraqis on the ground that went neighborhood by neighborhood and town by town to defeat the Islamic State.
Margaret Coker is the New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, the quest for a less wasteful takeout coffee cup. In Germany, people are turning to a strategy they often use when drinking beer. They're putting down a deposit when they buy a glass.
I finish the beer and then I give the glass back and in return I get the money back.
But does it work with coffee cups? Coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. In the northern Italian city of Genoa today, a major road bridge gave way. Cars and trucks fell from the collapsing freeway, leading to multiple deaths. Megan Williams is a reporter based in Italy. I asked her to tell me about the importance of this bridge.
The collapse happened this morning over a bridge called the Morandi Bridge, which was built in the late 1960s. And it's one of the most heavily trafficked bridges in Italy. Now, this is the bridge that's part of the A10 highway that sort of follows the Mediterranean coast. It goes up towards France. And today is the start of Ferragosto holiday in Italy, which is the mid-August holiday where many Italians, you know, travel either north or south. And that particular bridge is a passage that I've done many times and many Italians have for traveling for holidays. But it's also a bridge that's used by the people of Genoa. It's a very old city. It's a port city with narrow, congested roads. So many people in Genoa use that bridge just to get to work and back because it's a faster way to move from one end of the city to another. So when it collapsed, there were obviously a number of cars on it. I think more than 35 and three trucks and many casualties. We don't know the number yet, of course.
When you see images of this bridge and the aftermath, it's really dramatic. I mean, it's like a, 300-foot section of a bridge literally just collapses and drops. I mean, what are people imagining about how this happened?
People are in shock, but also not totally surprised, particularly about this bridge. As I mentioned, it was built in the 1960s, the late 1960s. And, you know, at the time it was considered a feat of engineering with new techniques. But shortly after it was built, problems emerged. And it's one of the bridges in Italy that has the highest expenditures for extra maintenance. There have been, you know, it's a bridge that's been plagued with problems. And already the cost of repairing the bridge and fixing some of the structural problems has outstripped the original cost of building the bridge. A leading engineer here in Italy is calling for it to be just knocked down and to start again. And, you know, I for very likely that will happen, given about 200 yards of it has collapsed.
I heard some people say that there was a severe storm going on at the time of the collapse, and one person said they might have been lightning. Do investigators have any sense of what exactly happened?
Again, listening to experts talk about it here in Italy, I don't think a storm, rain, or a bolt of lightning, even if it hits some critical steel beam or something, how can that bring a bridge down unless there are some structural problems? From what I understand, the engineers who have studied this bridge, who know it, say that, you know, this has nothing to do with the collapse.
Here in the U.S., you hear a lot about our need to rebuild our infrastructure. Is that a big problem in Italy as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key issue. And, you know, there's an infrastructure maintenance problem in Italy. This is not the first bridge by a long shot to collapse in Italy. Every year, there are 20 plus bridges that collapse. Now, they only make the news when somebody gets injured or killed. There are a lot of infrastructure problems on highways, bridges, certainly in the city of Rome. You know, it's potholes everywhere. But Italy is a country that's undergone a recession for the past 10 years or so. I mean, it's supposed to be out of it now, but there's very little government spending on infrastructure. And there's also a new populist government and a sort of an anti-government feel, an anti-tax movement, and where people see these sorts of expenditures as wasteful projects. And, you know, in the case of Italy, there is a lot of waste in them and sometimes corruption. So you can understand why people feel that way. But nonetheless, you know, to have functioning bridges and roadways, you need to spend money and you need to maintain them.
Megan Williams is a correspondent based in Italy. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thanks, Carol.
Let's turn now to news about the United Nations. The world body recently selected Michelle Bachelet to be the next human rights chief. Bachelet was, until recently, president of Chile, the first woman in that post. She also was founding director of UN Women, the Women's Rights Office. And she herself was a victim of human rights abuses in her country, having been tortured during the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Ariel Dorfman knows Michelle Bachelet well. He was born in Argentina, spent much of his life in Chile, and is now an emeritus professor of literature at Duke University. He told us first about Bachelet's father.
Alberto Bachelet, who was a brigadier general of the Air Force, was loyal to Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president, and as such was in charge of food distribution network so that there wouldn't be shortages of food among the people. And as such, because I was working with the government at that time, I met him on several occasions. And then, of course, I was appalled by the fact that he was then, after the coup against Allende on September 11th, 1973, he was taken to the Aviation Academy and tortured there so severely that in March of 1974, he died of cardiac arrest.
You eventually met Michelle. What was your impression?
I met Michelle Bachelet in 1986. When I presented a book of stories dedicated to the military men who had been loyal to Salvador Allende, and she came to that book presentation. She came with her mother, Angela Heria. That was 1986. I was allowed back in 1983 to Chile and was able to participate then in the resistance from that moment onward inside Chile. I was very impressed with how easygoing she was and how thorough and how dedicated she was, how devoted.
What's the significance of having someone like Michelle Bachelet as head of human rights for the UN, who was herself a victim of human rights abuses?
Well, we're living at a time when human rights abuses across the globe, in just about every country we can think of, have increased remarkably. So I think this is a moment when to have a figure like her, who knows what it's like to be tortured, who knows what it's like to be detained, who's lived for many, many months among people who have been even tortured in worse form than she herself was, and who at the same time is somebody who understands that the perpetrators are also victims in some way, and who can speak, therefore, from her own experience, and her experience both of not forgetting, but of forgiving, and of hoping that there is some atonement in that sense, I think she might be able at this moment, which is a crucial moment in the history of human rights, she might be able to have a real influence in that sense.
Critics have called Michelle Bachelet hypocritical. They say she cozied up to left-wing rights abusers like Fidel Castro. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would say that as a president of Chile, or as a person who is a part of the Chilean resistance, she must have her own ideas about who she will be friends with. For instance, Fidel Castro was a great, great friend of the Chilean resistance, therefore that she should be a friend of Fidel Castro is not strange. I think that as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she will have to criticize anybody and everywhere where these human rights abuses occur. I think we should give her the benefit of the doubt. My impression is that she will be very just and fair in the way she does this.
Bachelet has generally been pretty warmly received at the UN, with an exception, the U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley. In a statement, she referred to the, quote, failures of the Human Rights Council, unquote. And she said it's incumbent on the Secretary General's choice, Ms. Bachelet, to avoid the failures of the past. What is Bachelet up against here?
Well, I mean, I don't think that anybody from the Trump administration has the right to criticize Michelle Bachelet. The Trump administration has named a torturer or person who was accused of overseeing torture as head of the CIA. The Trump administration has separated children at the border, has illegally done a series of things, has worked against workers' rights, has in general, I mean, the president himself has said that he thinks torture works and he'd bring back a lot worse than waterboarding. So I really think that the ambassador of the United Nations should look at her own country instead of criticizing somebody who has a spotless record and who is herself a victim of real violations.
Ariel Dorfman is a human rights activist and writer. He lived for many years in Chile. He's author of Death and the Maiden and Darwin's Ghost. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Chances are that you got going today with the help of a cup of coffee. If so, did you drink that coffee out of a to-go cup and then throw that cup in the trash? If you did, it's because most disposable coffee cups can't be recycled. Yesterday, we heard about an effort by Starbucks and McDonald's to develop a to-go cup that can be recycled and composted. But some companies in Germany are taking a different approach to the problem of coffee cup waste. From our Livable Planet desk, here's Valerie Hamilton.
If you've walked through one of Munich's historic squares recently, you might have caught sight of a new, unusual monument, a giant coffee cup 15 feet tall. It's not just modern art.
Everybody is coming and saying, oh, what kind of big paper cup it is. And we say, look, this is the amount of paper cups you use every day in Munich.
Günter Langer works for the city's Waste and Recycling Authority, and that extra-large latte is a wanted poster for his public enemy number one. Munich throws away almost 200,000 paper coffee cups every day, enough to fill up that giant grande with trash.
Maybe it's an American way of life, which is spill over Germany or to Europe.
American-style takeout coffee has taken Germany by storm, and it's left in its wake a mountain of waste. Germany leads the world in recycling, but you can't recycle most single-use coffee cups. So, like the rest of us, Germany just throws them in the trash, nearly 3 billion every year. But Munich may have found a solution, inspired in part by another favorite beverage. Before the takeout coffee craze, most of Munich's public drinking was the hops and malt kind, beer. And that doesn't generate any waste. Here at the city's Chinesischer Turm Beer Garden, when you order one of those famously huge mugs of beer, you pay a deposit for your glass. And when you return it for your money back, it gets washed and used again.
I finished a beer and then I give the glass back and in return I get the money back. So it's just like I kind of borrow the glass for the time I'm drinking.
When I ask Alex Gerstmeier to explain this deposit system, she gives me kind of a funny look. That's because here in Germany, borrowing and reusing is completely unremarkable. Stores charge a deposit on beer bottles, and when you bring them back, anywhere you want, they're sent back to the brewery to be refilled. At music festivals and church fairs, instead of throwaway paper and plastic, you put down deposits on real glasses, plates, and silverware. So for Gerstmeier, there's no mystery about the deposit system, except maybe one.
The question is, why has it not been applied to coffee before?
Gerstmeier works for Recup, a Munich-based startup that has developed a new deposit system for takeout coffee cups. They're made of recyclable plastic that can be washed and reused dozens of times. But you don't have to return them to where you got them. Like with those beer bottles, you can bring them back to anywhere they're sold. We went to a cafe on Munich's Isar River to see how it works. You order a cappuccino to go. But instead of getting it in a paper cup, you pay the cafe a 1 euro deposit for a recup. When you finish it, instead of throwing the cup in the trash, you turn it in wherever it's convenient at one of more than 1,000 cafes in the recup system from Munich to Berlin. They pay you your deposit back, wash the cup, and reuse it. When it stops generating trash, your morning coffee looks a lot more sustainable. And recup proponents like Gerstmeier are hopeful it could go deeper, too.
It's a chance to change the way people think a little bit. Like thinking, okay, I'm not taking the paper cup, but I'm taking a recup. We think there will be changes throughout the whole way of how people consume.
Now, you might have noticed recup has not yet saved the planet. It hasn't even saved Munich. Only a fraction of coffee places so far are offering recups, and even there, not everyone is using them. And anyway, coffee cups are only a tiny percentage of the city's overall waste. But Günter Langer, the guy behind Munich's giant coffee cup, says recup isn't a solution, it's a symbol.
What do you want? Do you want to drink a coffee or you want to possess a cup? No. And this is a new idea, what we want to have. Use it, don't possess it.
He hopes that like his giant latte, recup will remind people that they have a choice for coffee and a lot of other stuff.
People think about your living, think about what you're doing, think about your lifestyle, try to relax, try to avoid waste, try to make your lifestyle more sustainable. And the multi-way cup is one small step.
And even though the city he works for is promoting recup, Langer says he doesn't use them. That's because he doesn't get his coffee to go. His sustainable solution is to order his coffee in a real ceramic cup, sit down at a table, and relax. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Munich.
You've probably seen this story on the internet. An orca whale gives birth, but the baby dies a short time later. The mom refuses to let the corpse sink and instead nudges it through the water for an unprecedented 17 days. The grieving mother struck a chord around the world. Killer whale biologist Deborah Giles with the University of Washington is on the phone. Deborah, I know there's some bittersweet news here regarding the mother orca. What's the latest?
The latest is that she has let it go. So, yeah, as you say, it's bittersweet.
What is the fact that the mother orca let go of her calf tell you?
That's hard to answer. The fact is that the body was coming apart. So either she was, you know, ready mentally to give up her calf, or there was becoming less and less for her to hang on to.
Was this mother whale grieving, or are we anthropomorphizing her?
Well, in my personal opinion, I don't think there's any reason in the world to think that she wasn't grieving. But then I know her as an individual. You know, I remember when her first calf was born, and I remember seeing her with her first calf, and she was a really good, attentive mother.
Do you know whether once this baby orca died and the mother orca began pushing her through the water, did scientists observe any reactions from other whales in the pod?
It's believed that her family was trying to feed her, so bringing her fish. Her previous calf, who was born in 2010, was often seen swimming near his mom.
Do we know why the baby orca died?
We do not. studies from the fecal hormones from Dr. Sam Wasser's lab, which is one of the research projects I'm proud to be a part of. We had a paper come out last year that showed 69% of pregnancies are lost before the calf is viable. That's a huge number of lost pregnancies, and that's very, very clearly linked to the lack of nutrition.
Are those statistics, do they relate to this particular pod or
it's very, very specific to this pod.
You mentioned nutrition as being an issue. What's going on?
So this population of killer whales is very, very, very honed in on Chinook salmon. And the Chinook salmon runs throughout the entire southern resident killer whale range are pretty much decimated.
Is the lack of Chinook or the shortage of Chinook in the inland waterways, is it a result of overfishing?
That is definitely one of the causes of the problem. So overfishing, the fisheries practices throughout this region are, in my opinion, need to be reexamined from Southeast Alaska all the way down to Northern California. And then other things like rivers that have been dammed and industrial waste being still dumped into river systems. We've got the city of Victoria in BC, Canada, which is just, I'm looking at Vancouver Island, and their sewage system is such that they're still dumping raw sewage into the Salish Sea. So all of these, you know, that's, I've just barely scratched the surface of what the problem, you know, where the problems are coming from. It's not one answer.
My final question is, were you surprised by the strong reactions around the world to this mother orca and how she treated her dead baby?
I have been struck by the outpouring of interest from around the world. I'm not surprised given how special these animals are. And I feel like if anybody around the world, if they got to learn about this population, they would fall in love with them as much as those of us who live here and get to work with them. Just, I feel like the world is galvanized behind this population in a way that they weren't before. And it's not, and again, it's because they just didn't know how amazing this population was.
Deborah Giles is a killer whale biologist with the University of Washington. She's been speaking to us from Snug Harbor in the San Juan Islands. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Finally today, we're going to go all futuristic on you. We're talking about a future where people have microchips implanted under their skin, and those chips are used to unlock things, like your front door or the garage, and to pay for things, like train tickets. Except that's not the future for a growing number of people in Sweden, it's the present. Those people have paid more than $170 each to have those chips implanted. A Sweden-based company called Biohacks International is a leader in the field. Reporter Maddie Savage went to visit a couple of early adopters in the Swedish capital, Stockholm.
Hi, are you Eric?
Hi, yes I am.
Great to meet you.
Great to meet you too.
In Stockholm's old town, we're surrounded by cobbled streets and tall yellow and red medieval buildings. It's not really a place that symbolizes disruptive technology to me, but why are we here?
Well, I live in a shared house just up the street, and I'm going to show you how I get in.
All right. Wow, okay, so you just opened the door with your hand.
Yep.
Thanks to a microchip underneath the skin.
Exactly. Come on up and I'll tell you some more about it.
Very cozy in here, lots of minimalist Scandinavian furniture and some cinnamon buns on the table. Mm-hmm. Eric, you're 30, a designer and a web developer,
yep.
And you're one of more than 4,000 people in Sweden who've got this kind of microchip.
Yeah.
First of all, show me where it is.
So it's right here, sort of above my thumb. Unless I clench my fist, you can't really see it at all. It just comes in a syringe. It just takes a second and it's done. They work exactly the same as your key tag, the thing you scan to get into your garage or into your office. But I think the really interesting thing is where these chips will go in the future, where it's not just a simple passive chip the same as your card, but when they can actually integrate with your body and take measurements and maybe keep track of how your body is doing.
So I'm Sylvia. I'm one of Eric's housemates. And I got the chip for 2 months after he organized a party, an implant party here. I was mostly curious, and I wanted to make my life a little bit easier. It also works with my office door. You can use it as your train pass or train ticket. And you have some gyms that also accept it as a pass.
Do you think chips could become mainstream? Do you think people of different ages, people outside the tech scene?
Yeah, I think it's one of those technologies that's very much in a baby phase. and feels a little bit silly right now. It doesn't do much, but I definitely believe that it's the future.
It looks like this is your office now.
Yep, it works the same here. And we're in. It sounds scary that you have a microchip in your hand, but it really is the same thing as your key tag. Besides that, it's very easy to take out.
Okay, Eric, well, we'll leave you to get on with your day. We should say that there are some concerns starting to be raised about microchips in Sweden. There's currently no legislation. The government hasn't actively approved or disapproved of them. And especially after the global Cambridge Analytica scandal, national debates about how data could be misused in future are stepping up. But overall, microchips are largely being seen as something very fun to try. And there's a lot of buzz about how they could be incorporated into people's lives even more in future.
Maddie Savage reporting there from Stockholm on the growing number of Swedes who are having microchips implanted into their hands. That's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. And by the way, we still open the studio door here the old-fashioned way. I'm Carol Hills, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.